Hello and welcome to Therapist Corner, the podcast that dives deep into the fascinating world of therapy and mental health. I'm your host, psychotherapist Sarah Rees, and I'm really glad you're here for another episode of Therapist Corner. Whether you're a fellow therapist, someone curious about starting therapy, or just keen to learn more about the mind and mental health, each episode we'll talk with leading experts, delve into effective therapy practices, and take you behind the scenes of what running a private therapy practice really involves. This podcast is designed just for you to gain insights into professional therapy, understand more about the business of therapy and psychological wellness in general. So grab your favourite drink, relax and join us for another discussion. Welcome to the podcast, Vicky. It's lovely to have you here, especially because I've been following you on Instagram for quite some time. And the rise and popularity of ADHD is just on a huge scale at the moment.
Yeah.
So on Instagram, you're known as the ADHD nurse.
Yeah.
And I'm always fascinated about why people do what they do and choose the specialist areas. Could you tell us a bit about your journey?
Yeah, I try not to go off on too much of a tangent, but it has been like a really interesting journey, actually, even looking back now. So I'm a qualified mental health nurse. So I've worked in mental health for 10 plus years now. And I was working in primary care mental health services. So out of like running clinics out of GP surgery. So often like screening for things like ADHD as well and making referrals into the service. And a job came up as a specialist ADHD nurse in the adult ADHD clinic. There wasn't actually, I'll be completely honest, like a kind of keen interest to go and work in that area, but actually it was a progression for me in terms of my career because of how it works in the NHS with banding and so on. And I was encouraged to go for it and thought, actually, yeah, it'd be good to have a change and kind to be able to specialise rather than generalise. So I was successful, got the job. But the interesting part is I know some people might not believe in kind of clairvoyancy and so on, but about 10 months before that, I did go to see a clairvoyant because I was going through a really difficult time in my life. And I almost, I don't very often, it's very, in terms of going to see a clairvoyant, but I just felt like I needed somebody to kind of give me an indicator that I'm on the right track. And she did say to me that a job opportunity is going to come up for you in the future and it's going to change your life. And I always write notes when I've been to see a clairvoyant because I like to sort of look back on it afterwards. And it was really shit because at the time I thought, well, no job's going to change my life. I might, you know, find a better job with, you know, a better pay or, you know, just think these
quite
things.
Specific, isn't it, what she said?
Yeah, and I was thinking, I can't imagine. And anyway, I let that comment go. But she did also ask me if there was ADHD in my family and she was talking about my son.
Did she?
And nobody in my family had been diagnosed with ADHD at that point either. So right. It was another comment that went completely over my head. I wrote it down, the ADHD ? And I didn't find these notes until a year later. And then it all made sense. So I was like, that's wow. So I believe in that even more now because, yeah, it's really straight. So I wasn't diagnosed until I started working in ADHD.
So how did that come about?
So it was actually my manager at the time kind of dropped some kind of gentle, subtle hints and I kind of, you know, brushed it off. It was all kind of lighthearted joke really at the time, just because she was obviously observing the way that I work. And in hindsight, I kind of think, well, actually, it's almost like I understood the people that I was seeing and assessing really naturally as well. So in hindsight, that makes sense because obviously for people that don't have ADHD, yes, you can read about it, or if you don't have that personal experience with ADHD, it is quite hard to understand from that person's perspective. But I feel like I just understood these people that I was seeing. So yeah, some kind of subtle hints were dropped, and then a more serious conversation, not in a, you know, negative way, but more so she was sort of looking out for me and said, well, I really do think you should have a look into it, and maybe that is the case.
How did that feel initially? Were you quite shocked?
I don't know if shocked as such, but the typical kind of like doubt, because I started to read more about it in terms of like trying to understand myself rather than the people that I was, you know, kind of treating or assessing. And the more I read about it, it just all started to make sense. And yeah, so I think actually it was more of a kind of light bulb moment. But I did also have the kind of doubts running up to having an assessment. I was referred out of county through the NHS purely because of the conflict of interest of like obviously I was working in the service. And I hear so many people that I see now say the same thing. They still think that they're going to be told at the end of an assessment, no, it's not. They sort of have that constant doubt and almost like imposter syndrome, isn't it? So I think I definitely went through all of that. But actually, everything made sense. Even when I spoke to my mum about it, and looking at school reports, we dug them out the loft. And I was like, I would have been like my own dream patient because there was just
it was so clear.
So clear.
And then could you see it running through the family?
Definitely, yeah. Yeah, so it was really interesting. So it was kind of, I feel like, yeah, the fact that I hadn't planned to go and work in that area, that I genuinely now believe in everything that happens for a reason. And like,
yeah.
Because, yeah, obviously going through all that, and it makes sense why it would be a job that would change my life, because actually it did, it for, you know, kind of reasons that I didn't realise were going to happen. And then obviously what I'm doing now, so I worked in the NHS ADHD service for 2 years. And I mean, I absolutely loved it there. And, you know, I've got a lot of respect for them and every other NHS service in the country because they're so overwhelmed, but felt really, really frustrated by the kind of, well, I guess, the time constraints, the lack of resources, and it didn't allow me to help people in the way that I felt they should, you know, and be able to offer what they need, really. So I decided to obviously look into doing it privately so that I could be more flexible. And yeah.
And how do you find working in private practice? Because obviously I support a lot of therapists setting up and building private practice. Has that been an easy transition?
No.
Definitely
not. I felt like it was really, really, like it was a really brave thing to do and a risk in a lot of ways, I think, because yeah. Actually it's not that common for nurses to go and work privately. It probably is more so for consultants. They tend to set up, and obviously therapists as well, it's really common. But nurses, it seems to be still really quite rare. Mm. So obviously it took a lot of hard work and determination, but I guess, you know, thinking from an ADHD perspective, it was something new, something novel. And actually when I get my teeth into something, there's kind of no stopping me. And so I guess like that's where that sort of impulsivity to some extent actually comes in handy.
Yeah.
You think, well, I'm going to do it and I'll worry about the rest later kind of thing. And it's worked out well. Obviously, it's, yeah, I wouldn't say it's easy.
So is it the right choice for you though?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. In so many ways, without a doubt. Yeah.
And did you niche right from the start? Because, I mean, that's something that often people go very broad when they start out in private practice. But did you start off as the ADHD nurse? Did you? And when was that?
So it became up to 3 years this year since I left the NHS.
Fantastic. Congratulations.
Thank you. It's gone back. Like saying that sounds weird because it still feels really new, but it's not. Even working in ADHD, I think so much has happened since that point in my life in general that it feels like it's just flown by.
Fantastic. There are lots of different types of ADHD, aren't there? Can you tell us about some of the different types?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I get asked about this quite a lot, actually, following an assessment. If somebody is diagnosed, we usually explain to them, and people want to know as well, because obviously there's lots of terminology that's thrown out there, isn't there? And they talk about, so there's a combined presentation, which means basically it's a combination of all of the kind of subcategories of ADHD. So inattention, which is, you know, lots of different things. So organizational skills, concentration levels, forgetfulness. There's lots of things that are associated with the inattentive type symptoms. Then there's hyperactivity and impulsivity, which again, there's lots of, you know, symptoms and how that can actually look in somebody's life. So it's a combination of those things. And then predominantly inattentive presentation, which a lot of people refer to as ADD, which is actually more so a term that they use in America, I think, mostly. But it's the same thing. It's just predominantly inattentive symptoms, so less of the hyperactivity and impulsivity, which it does seem to be more associated with women or girls than women with ADHD, but actually I meet men that have that sort of presentation as well, although it can vary. And there is also hyperactive impulsive type ADHD, which isn't as common. So it's kind of without the inattentive symptoms and more so the hyperactivity and impulsivity being a problem.
Wow, so lots of different types.
Yeah.
And it just feels like 2 minutes ago this was, well, I had it in my head, I'm sure many people did, that this was an issue for young boys in school and then they kind of grew out of it.
Yeah.
What's happened?
Well, I think it's been a gradual shift over the last, I don't know, say 10 years. And obviously because of more research out there, more awareness, and obviously like guidelines changing because of that. But I think there was a massive increase, wasn't there, like from the pandemic. And there's lots of theories around that. So in terms of people seeking diagnosis, that's when it's really...
around the pandemic time. Because my background's very similar to yours. My background's in mental health nursing.
Yeah.
And I managed the primary care mental health team. And then I trained to become a CBT therapist, worked in IAP. And at the time, we were not diagnosing or looking at ADHD. So to hear that a few years on, you were, it's interesting. So something happened around the pandemic.
Well, I think in terms of like the awareness. So obviously in Gloucestershire, where I'm from, there was an ADHD service, but it was relatively new still before the pandemic. I think it had only been maybe operating about a year to 2 years prior to me starting there. So it was still quite new. But with the pandemic, I know that our referral rate increased dramatically, like within the space of months. It was just, we were probably getting 50% more referrals than we were. But I think maybe people having, I don't know, there's different theories, people having more time at home and kind of reflecting on the things that they struggle with, or maybe the whole having to work from a home environment and realizing how distracted they are. Although for some people that's, you know, a positive thing and they actually work better in the home environment compared to in an office. But again, like social media as well really ramped up, didn't it, in the pandemic?
It did, yeah. We were all watching Netflix and a lot more time on social media.
Yeah. So, yeah, people have really kind of utilised that and it's carried on, hasn't it? Because it's got lots of positives for... and people sharing their kind of like lived experiences. And so I think there's obviously a combination of things, but I think definitely following the pandemic, that's when it really, really started to kind of like escalate in terms of people reaching out for ADHD assessments and so on. And obviously that hasn't slowed down.
Do you know what the prevalence rates actually are?
It varies, doesn't it, when you read different sources. But I think like generally if you looked at the average, because some sources will say it's around about, you know, and it depends what we're talking globally or in the UK. But I think in the UK, most of the statistics, I think, say around about 3-4% in terms of the adult population. In terms of children, it's around about 5%. So obviously there will be less adults diagnosed than compared to children. But then eventually, because of obviously the increase in adult diagnosis, I'm assuming that will kind of level out and the diagnostic rates will be similar. But when I've kind of, I mean, I'm not massively into looking at statistics and stuff. I hate numbers and but it's nice to try and break that down though, because actually, even for me, I kind of think if you're not into statistics, I think, well, that's all well and good, but 3-4%, what does that actually mean? Like, you've got to try and put that into context. And I don't always understand that, I'll admit that. But when you look at kind of, easier ways of understanding it, but 1 in 20 adults, I mean, that's quite a lot, really, when you think about it.
That is when you say it like that.
Yeah.
And I heard somebody, I think it was a podcast I was listening to, saying that we're probably all on some kind of spectrum. You know, if you really pinned us down and did a thorough assessment, that you could plot us somewhere on, you know. So actually, they said that they thought there was about 5% of us were neurotypical and then the rest of us were somewhere and had traits or, you know, which that really made sense to me.
Yeah, it does, definitely. Yeah. And like, but then I think that it's an interesting point, because I, when somebody has been diagnosed and they might share that with a family member or, you know, anybody else, and it's quite often like people get comments like, you know, oh, well, I do that. Everybody does that. We're all a little bit ADHD, or, you know, you hear these comments and it can be quite frustrating for someone who's struggling with ADHD symptoms and does have ADHD. But I think it's because actually everybody will have ADHD like symptoms. They're not unusual characteristics when you read what they are, but it's more to do with how often those things are happening. And actually the biggest thing that tips it over into being classed as a diagnosis then, I don't like the word disorder, but you know, it is still, you know, we haven't shifted from that, but that's what makes it a disorder, is the fact that it's causing disorder in a person's life in more than one area. So sometimes that's not always screamingly obvious in childhood as well. So because a lot of people might be fortunate enough to have, you know, structure from parents, but also their education set in. Some people don't. And then actually things are probably more obvious for those children that don't have that structure and support. But actually for a lot of people, and also like compensation for somebody, if somebody's, you know, quite academically able and their grades are showing that, well, you'll meet an expected standard, nobody would ever stand back and think there's a problem. But not thinking about how that, you know, or why their attendance is really low, why are they going to see the school nurse all the time to try and go home, or, you know, that's just one example.
Yeah.
Or the fluctuation in their grades sometimes can be, you know, even an indicator. They're doing really well in certain areas, but others like the complete opposite. But I don't think anybody would necessarily think, oh, there must be something going on here. We should probably get them assessed for something like ADHD.
And then I guess there's the resources are so short, aren't they? Especially I know for children's mental health, it's a real struggle.
Yeah, it is. It's. I think it's just got worse than ever, sadly. It's really difficult. And I think something that I feel quite strongly about as well is the way that things are done within the NHS is it's all based on deficit. So if somebody has, you know, kind of achieved through education, or they're holding down a job, or they're married, then actually, and they won't deny them the fact that, yes, you might have ADHD, but what I'm seeing now is that their referrals declined on that basis. Like, well, actually, okay, maybe you do have, but it doesn't warrant us seeing you. Your symptoms aren't bad enough to, you know, for us to see you, which I think is really unfair that somebody else gets to make that judgment about the impairment in somebody's life.
Absolutely. What are the waiting times like in the NHS now? Do you know? Or is it postcode lottery?
Definitely varies. I know that in Gloucestershire it's potentially up to 5 years. I think it's probably even hard for them to kind of gauge, because actually, yeah, it must be really difficult for them to gauge, because you can't take into account, you know, staff sickness then, for example, which would then slow the waiting list down, or how many referrals they're going to get in and things like that.
So five years.
I think that's an average across the country as well. It's quite scary.
What a shame. And you mentioned that there's difference between men and women. Could you talk to us about that, the different presentations?
Yeah, definitely. There is a lot of information out there about this. And yes, there likely is some differences between the way, between men and women, and the way that symptoms kind of present themselves, I suppose, or the problems that it might cause in someone's life. But I think that's more to do with the fact of like expectations maybe from society, and the way, although there's a massive shift from that, and that actually everybody should be very much equal, but that's not the case in reality. And actually the expectations on men is very different to the expectations on women still. We haven't completely shifted from that. And also there's a biological difference, isn't there?
Yeah, hormonal difference.
Yeah, definitely. Obviously women do have that, you know, kind of added extra that they have to cope with the hormone fluctuations throughout their life, but so do men, especially when they're, you know, kind of, yeah, late childhood and sort of adolescence age. That can, you know, cause havoc for them as well, and really bring things to light actually around that age for a lot of children with ADHD, because it just further exacerbates things. But I think, you know, for me, I work generally, well, age 16 upwards, but generally most of my patients are adults. And yes, okay, there are some differences, but actually there are a lot of similarities as well. Again, I think it just comes back to the kind of like expectations of, you know, from society about what men should and shouldn't be doing, and vice versa.
Mm, Yeah, that's interesting. One thing, I mean, I see it a lot more now in clinic, people asking this question, and I suppose it's something I've done lots of reading on and tried to get on the training, but that's all booked up.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if it's kind of in the theory at the moment. One thing me and my supervisor have been talking about is that some people don't present outwardly with the hyperactivity, but they present internally, so in their mind. Is that a thing? Yeah. So you might get a presentation of OCD or generalized anxiety, so really excessive worrying. And it's the normal CBT stuff just doesn't seem to cut it. And they just can't slow their mind down. Yeah. Is that recognized?
It is, yeah. Definitely. Just in terms of like symptoms that we would look for in an assessment, is that sort of inability to relax. And that can look like, it doesn't necessarily mean can't sit still and, you know, kind of up and down. And but even if it's like it's sort of internal kind of constant thoughts, you know, mind racing, those sorts of things. I mean, that can happen for lots of reasons, can't it, as well?
Like, yes, if somebody's
feeling anxious, that would happen. And I kind of home in asking questions about what their thoughts are, what are they thinking about, and you know, trying to see if there's any difference between, is it always anxious thoughts and things they're worrying about, or is it actually a mixture of everything? And sometimes, you know, when it's ADHD, it's generally a bit of everything. It's almost like word association, but thought association. They go from one thing to the next, and before they know it, they are, you know, miles away from where they started.
So just can't slow the mind down at all. It feels quite uncontrollable and out of their control. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
And if somebody thought from listening to this and hearing some of these symptoms that they might have ADHD, what is the first thing that they should do?
If somebody's thinking about it naturally, they do kind of steer towards the internet and start reading up about it, start maybe completing like online self-assessment tools, which is helpful to start that way. But I think having a conversation with a professional, whether that is the GP or whether, dependent on where they live, sometimes the process is the GP would actually forward their referral to a mental health nurse, like in primary care, don't they, to have that discussion. Because I guess what's important is ruling out other possibilities before kind of, you know, jumping to that conclusion, which is difficult because without having that full and thorough assessment, it is really hard to work that out. And actually, when you sit in front of the GP and they've only got 10 minutes and you want to go and, you know, discuss ADHD, you don't have time to think about all the other possibilities. So it's really hard. But I think taking some time to actually reflect back on, you know, how they were in childhood and trying to gather that information is probably the most helpful thing to do, so that whether it's the GP, whether it's a mental health nurse, or whether they're going, you know, decide to go and get a private assessment, they're equipped with that information from the start.
So school reports and things like that.
If they've got them, not everybody keeps them.
What would you be looking for in school reports?
So looking for like consistent comments about could be doing better. I'm trying to think of the typical comments that sometimes you read. And I mean, school reports are really interesting because I've even asked a teacher about what they generally write in there. And actually her feedback was, it was interesting because I thought, well, is this just, I read ADHD school reports because the people I'm seeing generally, not everybody, but most of them will have ADHD. And I thought, but do they write these things in everybody's school reports? And she said, generally, if there's comments in there that things like, needs to, you know, kind of focus more or not to rush their work. Yeah, not quite meeting their potential, could be doing better. She said, if those comments are in there, then the likelihood is that's probably happening more than what the teacher is letting on, because they're trying to be gentle about those comments. So the problem is probably worse than what it's saying in the school report. And I thought that's a really good way of looking at it. Yeah. But it's looking for those kind of patterns. So I could sit and read through somebody's school reports. It doesn't happen often, but some people will keep all of them. And I'll look from like primary school up to secondary school. And you can see a clear kind of decline as well.
Why decline?
I think obviously when they go up to secondary school, the pressure increases, doesn't it? And the expectations needing to be more independent with their learning and things like that. So it does really, really help having school reports, but not everybody keeps them, which is understandable.
No, I don't think I've got mine, no.
I didn't think I had mine until I raided my mum's attic and then
found them.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. Do you think it's useful to have that people seek out a diagnosis?
Yeah, definitely.
Why?
That could be a really biased opinion, yeah. but having gone through that, you know, personally as well, not just the people that I support now, but even if it's not about, obviously some people are kind of thinking they want to try medication if anything's going to help, but actually, even if medication didn't exist for ADHD, the diagnosis itself, and I think for the majority of people that have been through that process would say the same, that it gives people or allows them to kind of have that acceptance of their self, to be able to understand their self in that way. So some people will, you know, read up about ADHD and heavily relate to it and make an assumption that, yeah, it's quite possible they have ADHD, but they never really allow themselves to kind of think of themselves in that way. And I think that's really important because it stops the, not instantly, but over time, it stops that kind of need to adapt their self and their behaviour to sort of fit in. And actually they start to really embrace who they actually are and kind of, you know, I guess draw on their strengths and actually accept the things that maybe they struggle with more so. And yeah,
I imagine it comes with quite a bit of grief sometimes if you've struggled all through school and, you know, life has just felt a lot harder, and then there's something that you're struggling with and you had no idea, and then
Definitely. I think it's a bit of a roller coaster of emotions, really. And for some, it does vary. Again, it depends, doesn't it, on people in terms of their, you know, their backgrounds, their upbringing, and lots of things. But I think because it can bring some resentment as well for a lot of people and think, well, why did nobody pick up on this? And it all depends on the impact it's had on that person's life as well. For some people, it's massive, the impact. And you know, kind of things secondary to ADHD, so mental health problems or, you know, substance misuse problems or lots of other things. For people that have like significant kind of secondary problems to ADHD will have that resentment because they always think, well, if I was diagnosed, you know, when I was a child, then maybe none of these things would have happened.
Yeah. And what are the treatments like?
So in terms of, if we're breaking it down into kind of, I suppose, different types of treatment, but medication works amazingly for some people, for quite a lot of people. I mean, the response rate to medication is around about 70 to 80%.
That is good, isn't it? Yeah,
it's much higher than like psychiatric medications from you know, the research that's out there. So, but it's not for everybody, and sometimes it's trial and error, and it definitely does not solve everything. Like the way I explain it to people that want to start medication is looking at it as like the kind of foundations, and then you need to go on and work on everything else, the other stuff. But it's, you know, if it works well for that person, it gives them that headspace, gives them that calmness, that clarity to be able to really, you know, take a step back and engage in things like CBT, for example. Whereas it makes me think of, when you explained about trying to get a client with ADHD to engage in CBT, when their thoughts are going 100 miles an hour, it's really hard for them to focus on that and go away and practice the techniques that you've taught them and so on. So I think medication, when it works well, it does give people that foundation and that headspace, gives them a break from, you know, kind of even like the emotional dysregulation, even though it's not necessarily prescribed for that reason. We do find that for a lot of people, it really helps with it, but it definitely doesn't give people the tools and techniques.
Yes, yeah. So it's a combination, a more holistic approach. Is it medication something you've tried?
Yeah, yeah.
And how did you find it?
I honestly wouldn't be without it. I've been on medication since I was diagnosed, probably around about 5 years, just under 4 or 5 years. And yes, I've had gaps where I haven't had it. Obviously, the shortages, there's no perks to being in the job, unfortunately. We can talk about that. So I can be without it, but I wouldn't want to be out of choice because of the fact, the clarity that it gives me. It doesn't solve everything for me, and I definitely still struggle with a lot of the core ADHD symptoms, especially the executive dysfunction stuff, the organizational skills, time management, prioritization, all of those things that exist.
And that must be tough, right? Because you run a busy private practice as well, don't you? So how have you managed that?
Some days manage it really well. Other days I feel like I'm absolutely drowning. But then I think, is that running a business anyway?
Yes.
Exactly. So I think it's, you know, a combination of things, isn't it? But I think I'm probably a lot kinder to myself than I used to be.
That must make a difference.
Yeah. Definitely. And just, you know, changing my mindset. And I think actually medications played a massive part in that, just allowing me to kind of change my mindset and not getting caught up in the, because obviously there's, you know, the kind of rejection sensitivity, the fear of criticism, and which I think a lot of people struggle with anyway. But ADHD, it's very exacerbated. So running a business with all of those things to try and manage as well is quite hard. But it's not happened overnight, and I still every day think, I could do this, I'll try this, and try in different, you know, kind of ways of managing. But I think that will always be the case, and I'm a bit more accepting of it.
Yeah, because you instead of thinking that you're not getting something right, can you see that, oh, that's possibly an ADHD symptom, so you can work with it slightly differently, or know that if you get overexcited about something and a shiny new thing, that maybe you can slow that down, whereas before you might have just gone with it.
Definitely, 100%. I kind of reckon there's a lot of a lot more self-awareness that I definitely didn't have before. Yeah, I'm very aware of when I'm going down a rabbit hole, then, as people say. And even small things, I'll start doing something and I can recognize that I'll say, no, stop, what are you doing? And abort task, go back to what you were supposed to be doing. So it's just recognizing and stopping myself in my tracks to stop me losing time on something that actually it can wait. It's not
Yeah. And tell us about the medication shortages.
Oh, I know.
What's been happening now?
Yeah, it's been an absolute nightmare from my perspective because of seeing it, you know, the other side and trying to manage that. Obviously, with lots of people that are prescribed medication. But there are massive improvements. The problem started mainly with Elvance, which is probably in adults the most popular medication prescribed.
Okay.
And there are different, obviously, the increase in diagnosis and more people being prescribed treatment, yes, that has impacted it. But there were wider problems with a factory somewhere and them having to build a new factory in a different country. Okay. So there are things in the background that were kind of contributing to that. It wasn't just because of the increase in diagnosis, but that's improved. But what's happened now is more people were being switched to a different type of, or a different brand of medication to try and obviously, I guess fill the gap. And also more people being started on different brands that they maybe weren't used as often. So now it's almost like the problem switched to those brands.
Oh, right. I see. Yes. Because if you know there's a shortage, you won't start people on it, will you? So doctors are trying other things.
So it's just kind of, it's been really, really tricky. What I don't like people to kind of feel is that they are that reliant on medication that if there is a shortage or they can't have it, that they can't cope. So I think that's been a massive learning curve to make sure that there are ways and things for people to divert to if they don't have medication and they're equipped with those kind of skills and tools.
What kind of strategies or tips do you often share with the clients you work with?
So I think it's very much dependent on the person. There's never I know for a fact that what suits one person definitely doesn't suit the other. It does vary. But I mean, as a starting point, one of the biggest things and I would say to people is kind of understanding why they do certain things. So where the problem areas are in their life and why that actually happens in the context of ADHD. So getting them to understand about their brain sort of being very much interest and novelty driven, or that fear of immediate consequence, they recognise their actions, but don't recognise why that might happen.
So putting the pieces together.
Yeah. Because I think the more understanding somebody has of ADHD, and obviously they can get that understanding from, I try and explain it to people as best as I can. But even like, you know, kind of reading. So Ned Halliwell, any books written by Ned Halliwell, I really like, because it's very kind of like strengths based. He really focuses on, you know, the positive aspects of ADHD. And I know it's not all positive. There's no point sugarcoating it. But he does explain it really, really well, for in a way that people can, you know, kind of start to look at it in a more positive way and actually using it to their advantage and adapting their life and their world around them to suit them, not the other way around. So that's always like a good starting point for somebody to have that kind of understanding of what ADHD is.
Yeah.
You can't explain that in a sentence, what it is. It's really difficult because there's so many different...
So multifaceted, isn't it? How does CBT work with ADHD?
I definitely recommend it, but I think a lot of people that I see for assessment, and when we talk about CBT, they've already been through, not everybody, but a lot of people had CBT prior to being diagnosed or even acknowledging that they might have ADHD. So almost like... have had like maybe a negative experience, and I do always try to explain this to them, don't be put off having CBT if you have ADHD for that reason, because actually if it's focused on the right things and that person, that CBT therapist, has that understanding of,
you can then tailor it differently.
It's so different, isn't it? And that's the problem. I think a lot of people have been sort of treated for, say, anxiety and low mood. They've been referred through the NHS, and NHS services, they are great. And actually, if somebody has anxiety or, you know, a specific phobia, or, you know, and they do struggle with low mood, CBT is brilliant. But actually, if ADHD is the underlying cause, and they're not working, they're not getting to that person isn't relating to them, it's difficult, isn't it? And it's not as effective.
And sometimes it can, you know, if you've just got 6 sessions or 8 sessions, it's so hard to get underneath some of the symptoms, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's recommended in NICE guidelines. It is. It's recommended. I just feel like CBT's had a lot of bad press for people with ADHD, but I definitely recommend it and encourage, maybe not everybody, but especially people that struggle more so with like the emotional impact of having ADHD and the emotional dysregulation and the overthinking, the rejection sensitivity. And some people, quite a lot of people I meet actually do have sort of like perfectionism tendencies to avoid that criticism and all those kinds of things.
Yeah, so they've built up ways of managing. Symptoms. That makes sense, doesn't it?
Definitely.
Can you tell us a little bit more about your service and what you offer? I know there's an initial questionnaire.
We've got a short online quiz, which is a good starting point, I think. But screening tools, they have their limitations, don't they, as well? It's really tricky. So I would say, because there's lots of screening tools online and actually which you can just complete for free, can't you? But I think even if that came back as quite low, but somebody's still, you know, seeing that they struggle with these type of symptoms, I would still say don't be put off speaking to a professional, whichever route they go down. I think it's important. But so we offer a service, so diagnostic assessments for ages 16 and over. And the reason 16 and over, so generally I've always specialised in adults, but there's a real gap for adolescents, to be honest with you. And because of waiting lists in CAMHS as well, if somebody, even at the age of 15, gets put on the CAMHS waiting list, by the time they get to the top of it, they're an adult and they then have to
start. And they've done their A-levels.
And so it just feels really, so
it's such an important time in their life, isn't it?
So that's why I decided 16 upwards. And obviously it's my comfort zone to work with adolescents and adults rather than children. And I feel that with children, it needs to be more of a multidisciplinary approach as well. So we do diagnostic assessments. So I prescribe medication for ADHD if it's needed. And I have another nurse prescriber, Sarah Painter. Her background's a mental health nurse as well, who's a nurse prescriber. We do have a CBT therapist who works very part-time hours, who's kind of linked to us. And we kind of offer more of a, I guess, and people, to, this is the feedback we get from patients, more of a holistic approach or individualized approach to the assessment itself and what people need, because it's just everyone's needs are so different. They really are. And that's very cliche, but it is true. And so although our assessment approach is, you know, very much the same for people, the approach we take in sort of delivering that assessment and actually what people need afterwards, we adapt.
Fantastic. That's so useful. Because where do you see it all going, do you think? Do you think the demand will reduce?
I think the demand will reduce eventually, definitely. Yeah. Because I suppose the reason why there's a massive increase is, like, and the diagnostic, the statistics or the prevalence is higher in children that compared to adults, because adults are underdiagnosed still. And it's not like all of a sudden people have, you know, you hear terms like, oh, everyone's got ADHD now, like it's, you know, become contagious or something. But actually, you know, those adults were once children. So, and obviously those, it was really underdiagnosed in children, and it still is in adults, and it probably still is in children as well. But eventually that will level out. I don't know in terms of the waiting lists in the NHS. That's the bigger issue, I think.
Across the board, isn't it? I don't know. It just feels really scary.
And it is really scary for people, because, you know, I know that obviously with me leaving the NHS and working privately, you know, cuts out me helping a lot of people that can't afford to go privately, which I totally understand. And it's really, really difficult. Some people just don't have that novelty and they have to sit on that waiting list. And actually, quite often people reach out to go for an assessment when their life's in crisis and they're like, right, enough. I need. And then they're told that they have to wait for 5 years. It's really sad. It's really difficult. But it's such a big problem. And there are lots of conversations going on in the background and, you know, hopefully improvements that, we won't see any result of any of it, though, until, you know, probably years to come, because these things take time to implement. Yeah. But there are things definitely going on, and people, some of the leading experts in the UK who are part of the kind of committee for UCAN, who deliver diagnostic training and so on, they've recently issued so it's like a quality assurance research study that they have done, so to hopefully help GPs, because there's obviously a lot of issues with somebody going private being able to get their medication on the NHS at a later date, which is also compounding the problem. But it's a quality assurance study for GPs to be able to use to guide them with what does a quality assessment look like, to give them confidence with having, say, a shared care agreement and taking on somebody's prescribing of ADHD medication alongside of that specialist.
Yes, because at the moment you go and get the diagnosis, a private doctor or nurse prescriber might prescribe it, and then once you're stable, your GP can take over that medication, then you can get it on the NHS.
But that's just become more difficult, I think. And I understand it from GP's perspective. It must be really hard for them, because they don't necessarily get any you know, training or guidance around it, and they've got this huge increase in these requests from lots of different,
and then the frustration GPs feel when they've got to put somebody on a waiting list for 5 years is so hard, isn't it? Because when I worked in primary mental care, I think the waiting list was about 12 to 18 months just to see somebody for a standard CBT. It was such a long time, and
it's really tricky, isn't it?
So I'm working in private practice. You can see people a lot sooner, can't you? And take some of that weight off the NHS, because some people can afford to have therapy in different ways and support in different ways.
Yeah, and that's what it needs to be seen as. Everybody needs to be kind of, you know, joining up together and helping each other in this situation. But I feel that it's become this like quite big barrier then between, there's a lot of, I don't know what the right word is, really. I suppose, like, it's very controversial, isn't it, in terms of the whole private and kind of public sector services, which shouldn't be that way.
No, we're
doing the same job and wanting the same outcome in theory. So it's difficult, but there's so many different factors that, you know, come into play. And GPs are already, you know, massively under-resourced, aren't they? And kind of
yes, they are
under pressure.
I'll quite see people who are on an NHS waiting list, and I might see them for 4 to 6 sessions, and then their place comes up and I can just do a letter to kind of overview what we've done, and it just gives them a bit of a head start. Or sometimes they don't need to take up the place and they can come off that waiting list. It really varies, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, lots of work in the field of mental health. I think we could go on for a long time about that. It's really in crisis, unfortunately. So one of the questions that I ask all my guests is, if you could go back in time, what would you say to your 15-year-old self?
I would probably be telling myself to just be myself. And I think I really would. When I look back, it is quite hard looking back, really, but you can't change the past. And you've just got to reflect on it, accept that that's how things were. But I know that I adapted myself so much. Probably when people talk about masking, especially in girls and women, usually that masking they talk about is kind of like sitting there, you know, quietly trying to go sort of unnoticed, and so that they don't draw attention to themselves and people don't notice what the problems are. I felt like actually I was very much the opposite, which is kind of interesting, because I very much acted out. I was trying to draw attention to myself, but in the complete wrong way, to be liked, I think, and fit in. But that actually wasn't me. I've actually worked out. So I was like, if people that knew me at school probably said I was really, really outgoing, extrovert, very loud, attention seeking in a lot of ways, which, you know, is sad really looking back. But actually, I know that, like, as an adult, I've learned so much about myself. I'm actually really introverted, which is bizarre, because I always called myself an extrovert, but I'm not.
That must have been exhausting then.
Definitely, because I always had this feeling inside of me of, this isn't who I want to be. This is not who I am. But this is how I've portrayed myself to be. So I have to keep that up. It's really strange. Yeah, now looking back, because actually it's really difficult to then, like, be more yourself as as I learned more about myself as I got older, and especially I would say in the last sort of 6-7 years, I've been more comfortable in my own skin, and even more so after being diagnosed and everything making sense. But it's hard to undo that, and people I then wonder, and this is just me overthinking though, I do wonder, like, people that knew me in my younger years or when I was at school, they see me now and think, that's not Vicky that we know. Like, who she is?
And I think things like that feel very different, but probably not for everybody else, because we're all evolving all the time, aren't we? But you've got this huge amount of knowledge about who you are and your past. You must have had to almost rewrite.
Oh,
and yet, teenagers are tough anyway, aren't they?
But,
you know, you had a condition that you were working with that you had no idea about.
I just kind of labelled myself many things, really, and I think I was quite troubled as a teenager, and I always thought I was always called myself a bit stupid, a bit thick and things like that, which is horrible. I you know, if somebody sat there and said that about themselves in front of me, I'd be like, no, you're not. But I genuinely believe that I was, you know, wasn't very bright, and I'm not naturally academic, definitely not, but that's fine. I'm far from stupid, but I always believed I was, a bit stupid. I don't even like that term, but that's what I used to call, you know, myself.
So now you can rewrite that and think about it completely differently. And be kinder to yourself, which sounds like one of the kind of key things for you, and I guess for many people when they get this understanding of this condition, that they can work with themselves differently. Thank you so much for today. I've really enjoyed it, and I think you're going to help share some really useful information and knowledge with people that, you know, because it's out there everywhere we look at the moment. And if people want to find out more about what you do and maybe take that initial test, because it's nice to come to, there is so much on the internet, so it's nice to have one place that you can feel you can direct people to, where can people find you?
So my website is theadhdnurse.co.uk, And there's lots of links on there for, and obviously different pages, some, you know, generalized information about ADHD on there. But also in terms of like assessment process, there's a link to the referral form. There's an online test that you can take that will give you some feedback. But again, obviously it's got its limitations, but it's just a good starting point. And obviously if some people prefer just to get in contact, don't they, and have a conversation, we're always happy for people to pick up the phone. Our phone number's on the website, or drop us an email, and you can email us directly from the website as well.
And do you have a wait list?
We are currently booking into, I think, just around the beginning of May. We're usually around about 5 weeks ahead on average. Yeah, obviously the process itself is we would get somebody to complete a referral form first, and we would kind of make sure that it sounds like there's enough information there or evidence to suggest they need an ADHD assessment, which is difficult in itself, but it's just making sure that there's not anything obvious that actually they'd be better suited with a different service. Or so we do have kind of a screening process in place rather than somebody just being able to book in. And if it's like not really clear, and actually for some people this is quite helpful, we do have a screening appointment as a starting point before they then commit to a full assessment. And sometimes doing it that way around is less daunting for people, because especially when you're going private for an assessment.
Is that the QB test?
Yes.
And what does that involve?
So we do this actually with every assessment now. So just because it gives you some objective information. So it's a 15 minutes for younger people, 20 minutes, I think from 12 upwards, the test is slightly more complex. So it can be done between the ages of 6 and 60. So we'll talk about the adult one, but it's 20 minutes. We're doing a repetitive task on the computer, and it can be completed from home, in the home environment. We send instructions on how to do this to ensure that the results are as valid as possible. It basically compares the results. So it looks at all the core symptoms of ADHD, inattention, impulsivity, and hyperactivity, but basically it measures the level of movement throughout that test.
Okay.
And it compares it to a normative group. So it they've done studies between the ages of 6 and 60 on people without ADHD doing this test, so they can then, they know what an average test result would look like.
Okay.
And they compare your results to that normative group of people, and obviously taking into account age as well and gender. And then it will give us a likelihood of ADHD symptoms being present. But the results are quite detailed, so it will give us detailed results in terms of like the different areas that that person struggled with. So it will, you know, kind of look at how quickly that person responded. Was there a lot of variation in terms of how quickly they responded, which shows us when they might have zoned out and so on. It looks at the errors that they've made. And also, like I said, level of activity as well. So it's really good because you get quite a visual report of looking at a sample case, then looking at your results, and you can compare it.
And does, you know, now we are spending a lot of time, some of us, on TikTok and things like that. Very fast social media platforms, you know. Can't help but think that we are training our brains up. Like, I used to have to read a book because, you know, it wasn't, nothing like that was around. And now you can spend hours, and I know when I work with adolescents, they're spending hours every day on really fast, repetitive kind of short videos and things. Could you kind of train your brain up to look like an ADHD brain because of gaming, or
asked the question about gaming, so that's an interesting one, and whether that would have any impact on the test, but in the opposite way. So if somebody is, you know, really into their gaming and very talented in that area, that actually would they perform better on a QB test, as in like showing less ADHD symptoms because they're used to, that. And the answer was no, it had been taken into consideration, and actually it shouldn't have any relevance because the test itself, there's no pattern to it. So it's kind of very randomized. Okay. It's the same test for everybody, but the actual it's basically a sequence of like shapes and colors, and you have to, it's almost like a virtual game of Snap is the way I explain it. So when it's the same shape, same color you press, But you do that for 20 minutes. So, I mean, I think the point you've made potentially will have an impact over time in terms of, like, especially in younger people, like brain development and so on.
It has to, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, like, life has, I think there is definitely something to say with, like, the way life is now. It's so busy, chaotic, and there's so many different forms of, like, communication, isn't there? And, like, distraction all the time. We're surrounded by it. That, yes, that definitely comes into play with maybe some people thinking they have ADHD symptoms, and maybe it's not, maybe it is actually life. But I guess when you go through a thorough assessment, all of these things should be taken into consideration and actually looking for that lifelong pattern rather than obviously it happening in only certain environments or I guess time will tell with these things, won't it?
It will, because we're all constantly evolving, aren't we, and everything's changing.
Yeah.
That's been so useful. Thank you so much for your time. And
okay,
I will link to your website and your lovely Instagram and all your useful resources.
Thank you for inviting me as well.
Pleasure. Thank you.
That's all for today's episode here at Therapist Corner. If you're a therapist considering or are in private practice, you can join the Therapist Corner community over on Substack. And if you've enjoyed the episode, I'd be so grateful if you could leave a rating or a review. I read every one, and I'm always so touched by your kind and generous words of feedback. So thank you for all you do and your continued support. Until next month, look after your minds, and I look forward to catching up with you then.